Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Okay, so we're asking the question in this retreat, are we still human? And a kind of a bottom line on that first, yes, we are still human. We'll get to that in a little while, but let's go back to the beginning. And I think we need to ask whether we are human beings yet, and if so, what makes us to be a human being? What is a human being? Small question. And along the same lines, we can then ask what would make us fully human. Now, biologists have a kind of an answer to this question, which is fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go quite far enough. Let me explain why by asking about dogs. And if you know me, you know I always revert to talking about dogs or other animals. If you ask someone, what is a dog? They might say, well, it's a quadruped, has a wagging tail and a wet nose. Now, if you're a biologist, you add some morphological details, and these days you get down to DNA sequences. What's wrong with this? Nothing. I would say it's accurate, but it leaves something out. Now, even though dogs are indeed quadrupeds, this cutie shown on the slide did not stop being a dog simply because it lost a leg. And it's not just losses, it's also true for additions like cats with six fingers, or for that matter, human beings with six fingers. There's a well-known model of rejection of heart transplants in which you put a second heart into a mouse. You can take this point all the way down to the level of DNA sequences. Finding some DNA sequences among dogs, some differences among dogs, let's say Rex, Rover, and Fido, that doesn't mean that they're not all dogs, even though there are some differences in the DNA sequence. Why should we not conclude from such differences that, let's say, Rex and Rover are not both dogs? Now, scientists just don't worry about such things, okay? Even evolutionary biologists, whose job it is to worry about the origin of species, simply do not spend much time thinking about the definition of the word species. They simply don't find such questions interesting or relevant. They might worry about borderline cases, for example, whether dogs, coyotes, jackals, and wolves are the same or different species. But again, they won't define the word species. And in fact, if you ask them what is a species, they'll get kind of annoyed at you. What they do instead, which I make a point of doing, therefore, what they do instead is they perform statistical analyses of DNA sequence similarities and differences. And now, in contrast to that, among philosophers, this is an important question. And I'm going to speak about Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, and in particular, let's start with the difference between an essence and an accident, and then I'll say a few words about causality. An essence is what makes a thing to be what it is. There's a Greek formula. You can find it in Plato. You can find it in Aristotle, among others, and Thomas Aquinas adopted it too. Ta ti ein anai, what the thing is, or more literally, what makes the thing to be what it is? We can see why mere characteristics that we've been talking about cannot be the essence, all right? Because you can have a dog with three legs or with DNA sequences and so forth. So characteristics are not useless. They're certainly useful, but they are what Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas called accidents. Okay, which means they don't absolutely have to be there for the thing to be a dog or whatever. So what is a scientist doing in looking at statistics? When a scientist looks at statistics of DNA sequences, for example. Now, You can go a little further and divide accidents into propria, singular proprium, which is still an accident because it might or might not be present, but it's usually present. So a dog is a quadruped because they usually have four legs, though they don't have to. And on the other hand, there are accidents, or sometimes they're called accidental accidents. I won't worry so much about that. But, you know, whether the dog is named Rex or Rover or Fido or the best dog in the world, Nora, my dog. So how do we observe essences then? How can we observe an essence? How do we find one? Well, the answer from Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas is that we don't. Essences are not observable. They can be inferred, but not observed directly. So we humans observe a lot of four-legged animals with wet noses and wagging tails, and we make a category, and make the category dog. And it works. Why does it work? Because it wouldn't work, or it wouldn't continue to work, or it wouldn't work very well unless there was some correspondence of the categories we form with the real essence of the thing. Now, scientists, of course, are focused on what can be observed. And for this reason, perhaps among others, I think they stopped worrying about essences. So you take a thinker like John Locke, for example, who was also a scientist as well as a philosopher. He was an alchemist. And he was a very strong empiricist, and he distinguished between what he called a nominal essence and a real essence. And the nominal means we make a name, like dogs. Nominal essences are the categories we form and we name from empirical data. And for him, real essences might or might not exist, but since we can't observe them, who cares? That's basically what he said. Okay. Now I want to turn a little bit to causality, and Aristotle defined four ways in which people talk about, think about causes. Now, mind you, people say, call it this, the four causes of Aristotle, but a cause is a cause is a cause. We just think about them in different ways. A cause is a unitary thing. So therefore, these four ways of thinking about causes must be interrelated. So first, there's the material cause, that out of which a thing is made. There's the efficient cause, and this is mainly what scientists worry about, the material and the efficient cause. And Aristotle said that the efficient cause is the primary source of change or rest. So you take an archer, pulls back the string, lets the arrow fly, and that's the efficient cause of the arrow moving. Or the other example from Aristotle, a parent advising a child. The formal cause, or the form, is, again, what I've been talking about, what the thing was to be, which those of you who are grammar freaks, that is called a gerundive. Or we can also say what the thing was meant to be or what the thing is. And the final cause is the end, or the sake for which a thing was done. So sometimes we just call this the reason for. So Aristotle said that health is the cause, the reason for walking around. He gave his lecture walking around, and that's why Aristotelians are sometimes called peripatetic. Peripatetic means walking around. Okay, so now when a scientist talks about something, what is the cause of COVID-19? They focus almost entirely on the material and the efficient causality. So they'll say, for example, SARS-CoV-2 was the cause of this infection, and here are the proteins on the surface of that virus. But Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas insisted that causes are unitary, so the causes are interrelated. Let's take a fairly non-controversial example. Think about a clock. They're made of metal, that's the material cause, not silly putty, and that's for a reason. They have to move forward, the hands have to move forward at a steady pace That's the efficient cause. And for this reason, they are formed with regular gears so that the hands will move forward at a regular pace. And the point of the whole exercise is to tell time. That's the final cause. Now, as I say, scientists think about material and efficient causes, and if you think they'll get annoyed at formal cause questions, try asking them about final cause. Teleology, despite having 9 letters, is considered by most scientists a 4-letter word. They don't want to hear any talk about the philosophical why and wherefore of human beings. But I say, you got to step out of the laboratory every now and then and think about other aspects of being a human being. Now, one last preliminary topic before getting on to a kind of an answer to that question, what is a human being? Aristotle asked more generally, what makes anything to be what it is? Okay, he said that any substance and everything that you can name is a substance, it is the fusion of matter with form. Okay, so his example, well-known example, is the statue of Hermes. It's the fusion of some material, wood or stone, for example, with the form of Hermes. Now, this theory is called hylomorphism, where the word, it's a word he coined, hylo, or hule, if you want to be more exact, means wood, but it also stands for any other kind of material. And morphe is the shape or form. Now, it's not just statues of Hermes. You can go all the way down to a subatomic particle. This is a diagram of a proton, for example. It has 2 up and 1 down quark and some gluons holding it together. And that, too, is the fusion of matter and form. Now, some of you probably already realized that there's a big problem with this way of analyzing it. What's the problem? The statue of Hermes is made of the matter of stone or wood. But what's stone or wood? It, too, is a substance, right? So it, too, is the fusion of form and matter. And if you go down to a proton or a quark, problem is that our use of the word matter is different from Aristotle's. We use matter where Thomas Aquinas would use the word body. What's a body? It means it has 3 dimensions, basically. But to Aristotle, and Thomas Aquinas largely adopts this, matter is not a thing. It doesn't exist. It has the potential to become something. It has a kind of potential existence, according to Thomas Aquinas, but it's not yet anything. It is, in fact, potentiality. Matter, as used by Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, means potential or potentiality. Okay, so now let's come back to the question, what is a human being? To Thomas Aquinas, a human being is a rational animal. Note both rational, and we need to say more about what we mean by this, and embodied. Okay, now to the medievals, again, there are some beings, maybe to modern folks as well, there are some beings that are rational and not embodied, God first and foremost, but also angels, which Thomas usually called incorporeal intelligences or unembodied intelligences, more simply angels. Now, when I teach on Thomas Aquinas, I spend some time on his angelology. And they are unembodied rational creatures. And I use that as a way of thinking about the mind-body problem. Now, there's a corresponding thought experiment called the philosophical zombie. This asks, in a way, the opposite question. Suppose you have a being that looks and acts just like an ordinary human being, but does not have consciousness. Is this a conceivable thought? So it's been that question, that thought experiment has been given the colorful title, Philosophical Zombies. And probably those of you who are younger than me, which I think is everybody in the room, you probably don't know who this group is on the lower right, but that's okay. They were called the Zombies. They were a rock group from the 60s. Okay, now, what do we mean by rational? Now, of course, Thomas knew well enough that human beings don't always behave rationally. But he meant more than that by the word rational. And we have to define also what we mean by a soul. Now, I'm sure you know that a lot of people today don't believe in the existence of a soul. I don't know the numbers. But some people think about the soul as a misty, musty thing. And one of the people who thought that was David Hume, the philosopher, the Scottish philosopher. He was inclined to think he didn't have a soul. I think part of Hume's problem and part of ours is that we speak English. There are no obvious cognates for our English word soul. In Latin, it's really a lot clearer. The soul, anima, is that which makes us alive, animata. That's it. That's what the soul is. Okay. It is, and then I'll say more about it, of course, but, so saying that a being is ensouled means nothing more than the being is alive. In another way, this remains pretty mysterious. But, in any case, as far as the word is concerned, the soul is what makes the thing to be animata, alive. Now, the problem is that, people have a lot of unclear ideas when they try to say more than this. And one more point, Thomas Aquinas said that the soul is defined as the first principle of those things that live. Now, the key in this definition rests in the word first principle. We need a lot of things to be alive. We need a heart, we need lungs, we need kidneys, liver, brain, what have you. So these things are indeed principles of life, but why are they not a first principle of life? Now, this idea that Thomas argued against is that the soul is a body. The soul, he said, cannot be a body. Again, body means having three dimensions. Why can't the soul be a body? His answer was that bodiliness, the state of being a body, does not by itself confer aliveness. It's only certain kinds of bodies that are alive. Other bodies are either inanimate or dead. They're still bodies, but they're not alive. So whatever it is that makes someone alive is not just being a body. A living body is a certain type of body. In Latin, tala corpus. So what confers aliveness is something other than being a body per se. The soul, he said, now here's his other big idea about the soul. The soul is the form or actuality of the living body, the form of the living body. Now, this is, I think, a very clarifying way to think of the soul. And a lot of the lack of clarity stems from thinking about the soul as a body. And, okay, so here's the quote. I've already said it. So we'll just go on. This has led to some very bad science. And here's an example of this. In 1907, Dr. Duncan McDougall of Haverhill, Massachusetts, proposed to measure the weight of the human soul. So what he did was he took people who were dying of consumption, tuberculosis, and suspended their deathbeds on a sensitive scale. And as they gave up the ghost, as it were, he noted the difference in weight. And he said, aha, that's the weight of the soul. Now, so here's a cartoon, making fun of him. And the problem is, I would say, he got pilloried in the press for bad science. And the science was very, very bad. But I think his big problem was bad metaphysics. Because, again, the soul is not a body, so it doesn't have a weight. Now, our soul is not just rational. Our souls also have vegetative powers like plants and other animals, and they have sensory powers like other animals. And if we look at Thomas's science, it's pretty outdated. He pretty much incorporated Aristotle's science whole into his science. And one of the things I think we have to think very carefully about is some of the animals that seem to have something akin to rationality. It may not be full-blown rationality, but something akin to it. Animals, for example, have a property called numericity. They can't count, but they have some idea of what a number is. And I'm going to propose you a simple experiment to prove that to yourself if you have a dog, or find one if you don't have one. Show a dog three treats, then give the dog one and two, and you'll see immediately that the dog understands the number three. Okay? So they have certain kinds of language, or in any case, they're able to communicate with one another. And Darwin commented a few times on certain precursors or forms first of rationality in some of the animals. So I don't think we want to take this point too starkly about human beings being a rational animal, the only one. I'm not sure that's entirely true. But let's say more about what Thomas meant when he said that human beings have a rational or intellectual soul. Now, there are some technical details that we don't want to dwell, I don't want to dwell on. But first thing to say is that words like rational and intellectual were much broader for Thomas Aquinas than things like solving mathematical problems or thinking about DNA sequences. He defined the types of souls a living being has in terms of the extrinsic things towards which the soul extends itself. So you think about a plant with a vegetative soul, its living powers extend towards getting food and growing and reproducing. And an animal also has sensory things, but again, these are confined to bodies, meaning three-dimensional things. So finish up this thought, the rational soul can turn to an extrinsic thing that is not a body. Okay, and in the particular one he had in mind, of course, was God, but also abstractions, things that are not bodies. And to quote him, the rational soul extends towards, quote, the most common object, universal being. And this is, in effect, what Thomas Aquinas said was the essence of God, universal being. Now, one last point. Before we turn to the question of whether we're still human, Thomas insisted that we are not just our souls. The soul is not the person. Okay? We are embodied, and this is not just a sad accident. We are embodied in our essences. Our souls are central to who and what we are, not just unfortunate additions. And we need our bodies not only to live and reproduce and the like, but also for the sake of our souls. Why is that? Because when we learn, in general, we start with sensory data. So we need our bodies for the sake of our souls. Okay, now to come to the question of whether we are still human, the question I'm going to address is, what are the threats or potential threats to our humanity? And I believe the threats come from two directions. One danger is to ignore the soul, to consider ourselves to be only bodies. And I'll illustrate this by talking about Aldous Huxley's novel, Brave New World. The other threat is to ignore the body, or to try to go beyond it. And this is the case for certain types of transhumanism. So, for example, some transhumanists, they don't talk about the soul, they talk about the mind, but they talk, for example, about uploading their minds onto computers so that they can transcend carbon-based life and enter silicon-based life. And that's a very close paraphrase of some transhumanist writing. Okay, so let's start with Brave New World. About a decade ago, I Googled images for Brave New World, and what I got was a lot of images of human cloning in several of these images, and some of them have explicit embryos. Probably today I'd get more about AI. But the novel, of course, was published in 1932, and there was no laboratory method for cloning. Huxley invented a fictional process by which human beings could be made in a laboratory. He called this the Bokanovsky process. And the intent of this process, ostensibly, was to get fairly uniform products. Now, this is not what happened. So this is one of the cautionary points about Brave New World. Because of random chance events, noise in the system, as it were, there were gradations in how the process turned out, and this gave rise to classes. So in the Brave New World, there are castes, really, alphas, betas, gammas, deltas, and epsilons. And so this inequality required an elaborate state propaganda machinery to keep everybody satisfied. So you would tell the betas, for example, being a beta is best for this reason, and so forth, so on, for all of the castes. So turned out that although the aim was to make everybody uniform, which is not a particularly good goal anyway, but the reality was that there was, in the end, an even stricter hierarchy than what they had had previously. So this is, I guess, a cautionary tale about how things can go wrong even with the best of intentions. People doing the social engineering might or might not be competent. Now, I think you know who this sheep is or was. In 1996, Dolly the sheep was born. She's a clone. And the process is called somatic cell nuclear transfer. And I show this to remind us again that it didn't work on the first try or the second. And no, the third was not the charm. It took 277 tries. Okay. Now, cloning has been done on primates. A few years later, 20 years later, 21 years later, 2017, this headline appeared. And of course, many theologians, and I think Thomas Aquinas included, would avoid using the word create in this context. I think he would say made. Anyway, in the Brave New World, how many of you have read it? Probably most of you, yeah. Okay, I'm going to say a little bit about the plot just in case, because I know some haven't. A world state was set up after a horrific 9-year war. It was to be the ultimate rationalization of society, and the model for that society was Henry Ford's assembly line. And does anyone know where Henry Ford got the idea? He ran slaughterhouses in reverse, explicitly. So remember, this is satire. Well, we'll come back to this in a moment. This society was indeed successful in eliminating a lot of evils. Hunger, disease, war, among other evils, were gone. And yet people were miserable. Okay? This is dystopia, not utopia. What went wrong? Well, the founders of the Brave New World were altruistic. And this is one thing that differentiates Huxley's dystopia from, for example, George Orwell's. Using technology, they succeeded in eliminating a lot of evils, but this was achieved, in quote marks, by a combination of genetic manipulation, psychoactive drugs named Soma in this novel, and soul-deadening high-tech amusements. So along with the achievements came human debasement, shallow debased people with uncommitted, unhappy lives. It was the death of the soul. Now, Thomas Aquinas said, again, that human nature is an embodied, rational soul, and this point was forgotten or ignored by the founders of the Brave New World. The question is, if humans could be altered without limit through genetic manipulation, psychoactive medicines, other technology, would such a thing as human nature still exist? Or, as we might put the question, is human nature an obsolete term? The problem in the Brave New World is that the alterations were all aimed at the body without any mind to the soul. So diseases get eliminated, which is good, but there was no care for the soul. Now, I want to focus on one particular character in the Brave New World by the name of Mustafa Mond, who is the resident world controller of Europe and one of the architects of the world state. This character was based explicitly on the character of the Grand Inquisitor from Dostoevsky's masterpiece, The Brothers Karamazov. This is a complicated story in itself, which I'll be very happy to go into more details about during the discussion. But I think, by the way, how many of you have read Brothers Karamazov? Those of you who haven't, correct this error. Well, I'm just going to give you this one quote, and I'll give you some flavor of the Inquisitor's message. With us, everyone will be happy, and they will no longer rebel or destroy each other, as in your freedom. Who's he speaking to? He's speaking to Christ, who has returned to earth. Okay, for Dostoevsky, the heart of being human was to have freedom, freedom of the will. And this, of course, includes, unfortunately, the freedom to act badly and to sin. But when people trade their freedom for temporary gains like material comforts, this entails the loss of their humanity. So the Grand Inquisitor says of human beings that they're poor, weak, stupid creatures, so they need his guidance and his command and so forth, rather than their own freedom. And that turns out very, very badly, of course. Now, back to the Brave New World. Towards the end of the novel, he talks with another character named John, and he tries to justify the ways of the state. Now, John is always referred to as John the Savage because he was raised not in Europe, not in the Brave New World, but in the United States, and there's a long story about that. He only came to Europe as an adult. One of his peculiarities was that he learned to read on the only book that was available to him, which was The Complete Works of Shakespeare. So in his speech, he's always quoting Shakespeare. And in fact, the title of the novel comes from these lines from Shakespeare's The Tempest. He's very impressed when he first comes to Europe, and he says, "Oh, brave, oh, wonder, how many goodly creatures are there here, how beauteous mankind is, oh, brave new world that has such people in it." And of course, as he lives there, he grows increasingly disillusioned by the new world and comes to hate it. So at the end, he has this conversation in which Mustafa Mond tries to justify the world state to John the Savage. I want to come back to a point I mentioned a while ago and fill it in a little more. So Thomas said that the rational soul is rational in that it has a natural aptitude to extend towards the most common object, universal being. When he wrote universal being, he was, of course, I think, speaking primarily about God. And here is, I think, a central idea, and to me, this is the most mind-blowing idea in Thomas's writing, and I think we should just take a moment to ponder it, where he says, God is not only his own essence, but also his own existence. And that is to say that God, what God is his existence. There's a lot of ways to rephrase that. He says this in his question on the simplicity of God. Basically the first thing he says about God after he says that God exists. So you can say that for all other beings except God, essence and existence are not the same. I might exist or not. I once didn't exist. Someday, I'm trying to disprove this, but someday I will no longer exist. And so even non-existent things have essences. You can talk about the essence of a unicorn or the essence of a Martian. So essence and existence do not necessarily go together, except for God. Okay, so to say that in God and only in God, essence and existence are the same has many implications. So essence and existence are not the same. The essentia or essence is what a thing, a substance is, whether it's real or existent or not. And essa or existence is having in the creatures or being in God the act of existence, actually existing. And so here, God is not only his own essence, but his own existence. Now, another way to say that, is that God is the only necessary being. The rest of us are all contingent beings. Now, I want to bring up one more item before going back to Brave New World, and that is the transcendentals. In brief, the transcendentals are universal properties of all being. And there are five or six, depending what you believe, I would say six transcendentals that were named by Thomas Aquinas, and they're listed here. Basically, a transcendental is to be found in any existent being. Okay? So, goodness, truth, beauty, in a way, the most intuitive of these. Now, I'm going to say two more things about transcendentals before turning back to Brave New World. And the first is where the word comes from. They transcend the categories of Aristotle. If you want to know more on that, more on request. And the second thing is, here's an extra side with lots of other bits and pieces about transcendentals, again, on request. All right, so let's come back to Brave New World. I want to analyze the program of the Brave New World as an attack on the transcendentals. And as such, it's an attack on God and on human freedom. He attacks human freedom because he believes, Mustafa Mond I'm talking about, attacks human freedom because he believes, like Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, that human beings are too stupid or weak or unruly to handle freedom, and therefore they need to be controlled. So let's start going up from the bottom. Mustafa Mond, the world controller, calls art obscene, including John's beloved Shakespeare. Now, it's clear, however, that what Mond means by obscene is that art can be subversive of his own political power. Now, needless to say, there's no religion in the Brave New World, or at least no God, in the sense of a creator or a supernatural being who transcends the natural world. What might be a little more surprising, however, is that science is also banned. And the Brave New World, of course, relies a lot on technology, and yet science is banned. So the irony is that Mustafa Mond used to be a scientist. And those of you who have read Brothers Karamazov will know that the Grand Inquisitor used to be a lover of humanity and a very spiritual man. And now here he is trying to subvert Christ. But Mond, like the Grand Inquisitor, has turned against the source of truth. As he says, every discovery in pure science is potentially subversive. So there's that word again of political power. Science must even be treated as a possible enemy. Yes, even science. Now, I want to dwell on this point just a little bit. Science and technology clearly have a lot to do with one another, yet there are distinctions. Consider these four objects. There are two very obvious ways to group these objects into pairs. So, first, one can pair them on the basis of morphology, balls on the one hand and nets on the other. But the other way is to group them functionally, basketball with a basketball net, volleyball with a volleyball net. Now, let's try these four terms. Science, technology, religion, magic. And again, there are two ways to pair them. A lot of people would, I think, pair science and technology, and I don't really disagree that much. But that would leave magic and religion together. And again, there are a lot of people who would be happy to see it that way. But I think there's another way to do the grouping, and that is this way. Science and religion have to do with seeking the truth, whereas technology and magic have to do with praxis, with power, with being able to control stuff, okay? And so the world controller wants the power of technology, but he is suspicious of knowledge. And the good, too, has been banned in the Brave New World. Huxley focuses mainly on sexual morality, and to summarize a lot, sex is almost mandatory, but relationships are almost forbidden. Not almost, they're forbidden. You know, I think it goes way beyond sex for the novel. Now, the last three of these transcendentals are a little bit less intuitive, but I want to say a couple of words about them. Aliquid means something, and it's really about relationality. Okay, if you identify a thing as something, you're saying that it's not you, it's other, so you're positing a relationship between yourself and that thing, or between one thing and another thing. Now, in the novel, all familial relationships have been abolished, and again, in general, there are only the most superficial of relationships between human beings. And this is one of the main sources of dissatisfaction among the characters in the novel. Now, unum means one, and for Thomas, this referred to the fact that we identify things or people as things by noting their individuality or unity as a being. All right, this is a dog. In the Brave New World, there is an explicit attack on individuality. And finally, res means thing, and the term refers to the fact that a thing is a thing by virtue of the fact that the essence of that thing, of having an essence, and that it is actual because it has been given existence. So in another way, both of these last two transcendentals go directly to the topic of God, which Mond seeks to deny. He states that either God does not exist, or if he does, has no direct bearing on our lives. Either way, to Mustafa Mond, the resident world controller, God is irrelevant to our lives. And what this misses, of course, is that this is such a life is very, very shallow indeed. Now, ectogenesis, a word I use in the title of this talk, means birth outside of a uterus. And the Bokanovsky process is a fictional example of this, but now animals can be cloned. Human cloning has been outlawed everywhere, but clearly human cloning is technologically feasible. To clone a human being would be to treat a human being purely as a machine. Now, René Descartes made a radical separation between the mind or soul and the body. But as for the body, he treated it like a machine. And science, in effect, does this as well. When it studies the human body, in effect, it treats the body as a machine. But more importantly, Descartes did not deny the existence of the human soul. He did, however, deny the existence of the animal soul. Anyway, here's one statement from Descartes comparing the human body or any of the various parts of the human body as machines. He just said that the machines inside our body have much smaller parts than the machines we make artificially. That was basically the distinction. There was a later philosopher, Julien Onfray de la Mettrie, who went further and declared that the soul is just a fiction altogether. His book was called L'Homme Machine, Man a Machine, and he argues that human beings are complex animals and just machines. Now, I want to point something out here, and be on your guard here. When people make statements like that, they often sneak in modifiers like just or merely or only, just a machine, only a machine, merely a machine. It's a distinct diminishment of the human person. Now, if cloning would treat human beings as mere machines, there's a relatively recent movement that disturbs the balance of body and soul or mind in the opposite direction. And again, that's transhumanism. There are many types and forms of transhumanism, but I'm talking about the ones that disparage the body and talk about, for example, uploading one's mind. They don't speak about soul, but one's mind, and they hope to cheat death. Now, Dante was perhaps the first person to use the word, but he used it in a decidedly Christian context. This is from the first canto of Paradiso, where he paired going beyond the human to God's grace. Okay. Now, in modern usage, However, the word transhumanism came from a 1957 essay by this man, the biologist Julian Huxley, descended from Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. And he wrote an essay called Transhumanism, New Bottles for New Wine. And most of the essay is benign enough. He argues, for example, that human beings should better themselves through science and technology. Fine, I have no argument with that. But on a darker note, he includes eugenics among the ways we might better ourselves. Now, in my second talk, I'm going to talk more favorably about technology than I've done so here. But I want to end by relating transhumanism to another set of sources, historical sources, and this is about making a homunculus. The word homunculus means literally little man. What cloning and homunculus have in common, one thing, is that they both despise women. They try to bypass the normal path of reproduction. The figure in this slide, Paracelsus, was a physician, astrologer, alchemist, and he really had a problem with women. He also claimed to have made a homunculus. And this is a passage from one of his writings. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically what he did was to take human sperm and put it in a glass vial, sealed vial with venter equus. Now, venter equus means the belly of a horse, but here's a hint. It was not from the front of a horse, it was from the back of a horse. It's horse manure. So he sealed it up and heated it for 40 days, and he claimed to see a little man. A living human child grows therefrom with all its members like another child, which is born of a woman, but much smaller. And in other passages, he claims that it's almost transparent because it barely has a body and is therefore transcended ordinary human existence. Now, Paracelsus is often confused with this man, who is perhaps the historical prototype of Dr. Faustus. And he was a bad theologian, an alchemist also, and a magician. And as I say, likely the source of the Faust legend of a wicked man who made a deal with the devil in order to gain 24 years of power. And he wastes that power in trivial pursuits and dies a horrible death after that and is dragged down to hell. Now, the story had a kind of a fascinating journey. It started off in Germany, where it was the stuff of an early form of cheap entertainment called chapbooks. And this is the cover of one of the surviving chapbooks of the Faust story. And from there, it traveled to England. And Christopher Marlowe picked up on it and wrote his best-known play, Dr. Faustus. But notably, he changed it and made Dr. Faustus, as he said, tragical. Now, there was a lag of some decades. The story migrated back to Germany, and it became popular again, but this time in puppet shows. And that's where the young Goethe first saw it and ultimately used it as one of the main sources of his great drama, Faust. Now, in the chapbook, as I say, Faust was a very bad man. Goethe makes Faust even more sympathetic than Marlowe does, but he's definitely a mixed bag. He has some bad sides and some good sides. But one of the things he does is he also makes a homunculus, or rather his pedantic famulus assistant Wagner does. And the homunculus then becomes a character in the drama. And Goethe subtly makes it clear that Wagner's success in making a homunculus after many and long failures has at least as much to do with the devil figure Mephistopheles as any human effort. Now, the homunculus of both Paracelsus and Goethe is almost entirely stripped of his body. And indeed, Paracelsus's motivation, as also the motivation of the character of Wagner in Goethe's play Faust, is to reproduce human beings without the beastly act of copulation. This is despising the body. So we see in this figure the human being, the fragile homunculus, which can only exist encased in glass, and as the verse makes clear, Paracelsus also makes the homunculus transparent. So for them, the body is something to be shunned and done away with. Okay, so now, last slide. To repeat then, Thomas Aquinas viewed human beings as embodied creatures with rational souls, a union of soul and body. Neither the body alone nor the soul alone is the person. Human beings need a body, not just for the sake of the body, but also for the sake of the soul. And the soul, we need the soul, because that's what makes us alive. And even though he defined the soul as the form of the living creature, the human body is not just an unfortunate accident, a weight that we have to carry around. Being embodied is essential to being a human being, a living human being. This is, if you will, a very modest and moderate form of dualism. And by the way, I just want to mention one thing in passing. When Augustine talked about heaven, he talked about the glorified body. So he at least believed that even in heaven, human beings will need some kind of body. Okay. Let me add parenthetically that also that every time we take the Eucharistic host and talk about Christ on earth, we're acknowledging the essential nature of the human body for human life. The problem in ectogenesis is that it gives too little dignity to either the body or to the soul. Cloning tries to see the human being as only a body. The homunculus put too much emphasis on the soul. And of course, certain types of transhumanism, they don't use the word soul, but they worry too much exclusively about the mind as something that can be uploaded onto a computer, and we wouldn't then have a human being. So they tend to look upon the mind as sadly weighed down by a body. And as such, I think both l'homme, machine, man the machine, and the homunculus miss the true and beautiful dignity of the full human being. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.